You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
On this week's very special International Women's Day, I am joined by a powerhouse of a woman who is paving the way for change for women in business. Nafisa Bakker is co-founder and CEO of the award-winning media platform Amalia, which is one of the UK's leading platforms for Muslim women. After graduating with a degree in natural sciences, Nafisa learned to code and built Amalia with her co-founder and sister. Today, Amalia has a digital footprint of over 6.2 million each month and creates meaningful moments for Muslim women to feel seen. Nafisa is also the author of How to Make Money, a new honest guide to starting and building a six-figure successful business. Nafisa, welcome to the podcast and thank you so much for being my International Women's Day guest. We first met a year ago, can you believe, on an International Women's Day panel. And I really was blown away by, first of all, your level of expertise, but also your, you know, attention to detail on what you really care about when it comes to championing women, particularly in the workspace. So I thought my first question for you, because I often think that we have these different interpretations of what International Women's Day is to really ask you what International Women's Day means to you.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Such a pleasure.
So International Women's Day for me, I don't know if this is the jaded version that has come over the years, but it was a couple of years ago where I was doing a fashion shoot for Warehouse and it was for International Women's Day. It brought lots of different women together. And I remember that week where there were like loads of events, loads of you're on this list, you're on that list, loads of celebration, loads of great things happening. And I just thought, I bet my auntie back home has no clue that today is International Women's Day. And so for me, since then, I've always thought of International Women's Day as an opportunity to reflect on all the women, both here around the world, who won't be celebrated, who won't be on all these lists and at these glitzy events that we get to go to. I think about women across the country and here, in Sudan, in Congo, in Gaza, in Syria, around the world, who for them, International Women's Day might not be a day of celebration. And so for me, it reminds me of the many privileges I get to enjoy from being a woman and what International Day then brings for me.
And also, I guess, how you can then pay that back into the world. You know, part of your job and your whole career has been paving the way for particularly Muslim women in the kind of career space. So I guess I love that description. And I think you really raised some salient points in terms of, you know, we can often think of International Women's Day as this big campaign that tends to happen across social media. And it's like you said, all very glitzy and all very, oh, look how amazing it is. And we really forget, I guess, the core point of it, which is to amplify women's needs around the world and not just here in the UK. And I think, you know, such an important point to make. So I guess, like I said, you've built a career through championing women, through really helping them to navigate their careers, whether that be receiving fundraising, whether that be just learning how to tackle a pitch or even write a pitch deck. So talk to me about how that idea first came about. You left university with a degree in natural sciences. It's not necessarily the first thing that you think of when it comes to then helping other women in their careers. So what was the pathway from that to then, I guess, building Amalia and really feeling as though there was a gap in the market for something like that?
Yeah, so the first time I thought of Amalia and it as a concept and something I might want to do, I was in university. And prior to university, I'd worked at an engineering company. And that job made me realize that I wasn't motivated by money in the way that I thought I was. And it's ironic because I've now written a book called How to Make Money. But I think for me, that set me onto a journey during university to be like, what's the thing that I want to do? What's the thing I want to do? Everyone's saying they're going to go into the corporate world. Everyone's saying they're going to go into banking, consultancy, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought there must be more. There must be something else. And I kind of just started working on Amalia, which back then was actually a fashion platform for Muslim women. And it slowly started developing into its own idea and what it is today, which is a media company. And the landscape at the time, which sadly hasn't changed that much, is that Muslims in the media in particular were being represented in really negative ways. So there's a great study on this about the state of Muslims in media, and it shows that 1 in 3 articles link Muslims to negative behaviors. 59% of articles link them to misrepresentation and negative representation. And overall, Muslim women in particular are often only passed the mic to talk about the politics of being a Muslim woman, in whether it's here, whether it's abroad, wherever it is in the world. And we wanted to create a space which just is an ode to the fullness of what it means to be a Muslim woman, from everything from writing about dating to career advice, to money advice, to where to go on holiday, what books to read. We do loads of events. We've got a book club. We did a Galentine's pottery event. And we just wanted a space which was on our own terms, which wasn't for any other gays, and really created a global community for Muslim women here in the UK and abroad. And that really happened by just growing into that ambition and that mission. It wasn't something we set out to do, but more and more, we just had a lot of feedback from Muslim women saying, there's something here, I really like what you're doing. And it was actually when our blog started taking off that we realized actually we're a media company. And then understanding what that meant, understanding we then work with brand partners. We've worked with brands like Lloyds Bank, Lush, Pinterest, Tesco, and they all come to us and say, how do you create a campaign that speaks to your audience? Because again, Muslim women have been forgotten in so many different ways in different industries. So it was just a case of take one step and the rest of them show it themselves.
I love that. And I think that it's such an incredible platform. And I remember hearing about it on the panel last year and thinking, what a pioneer you are in that space. One of the things I learned about you when I was doing my research for this podcast was that you taught yourself to code, which just blew my mind, because like as someone who has an app, like that is pretty impressive. I mean, incredibly impressive, actually. You obviously showed a great amount of tenacity and drive to notice that there was a gap for something and to really recognize that you could fill that gap with something really important. You described that there were different iterations of Amalia, and I really like that when it comes to being a business owner and really sharing that, you know, the first idea isn't normally what the end product tends to be. Can you talk me through those different iterations? You said it was a fashion company first. I'm really interested to hear about, I guess, the journey of how you've got to where you are now.
Yeah. So the first iteration was we would curate clothing from lots of different high street retailers for Muslim women who wanted to dress fashionably but covered. And that was doing really well. We would have loads of attention on it. We were working with brand partners. And then we started this blog. And the aim of the blog was to just talk about things to drive more traffic to the website, to get more goods bought, right? And I always knew we were more than a fashion company, but I never knew what that meant. And I'd even, when we were speaking to investors, when we were speaking to potential mentors, I would always almost embarrassingly say, we're more than this. And I think when I look back at that time, it's that ugly teen phase of an idea where only you in your head can see how bad it is. Everyone can see how bad it is, but only you can see how bad it is in relation to where you want to go. But for me, I had spent about 2 years sitting on the idea, telling myself, why would I be able to do it? I've just come out of uni. I have no network, no capital, no skills, no industry knowledge. Whenever I'd apply for anything that was like a startup bootcamp, they'd be like, what's your domain expertise? What do you know about this industry? And I'm like, I don't know. I just think it needs to exist. And And my philosophy when it comes to business is just get something out. And that was very much our era of just put something out, see what happens. And from that point, honestly, things snowballed. And I describe it as when you're on a roller coaster and the seat goes down and you've got no choice but to go on that ride. And so I quit my job after university. I worked for my university. I was in the company, and my manager gave me a promotion. And he was also very entrepreneurial. He loved the concept of students going on to do entrepreneurial stuff. And I just went and spoke to a friend and I was like, look, I've got like this other option, but I'm trying to work on this thing on the side. By that point, I'd learned to code because I was like, okay, I've got all these gaps. I'm going to try and fill as many as I can. I'm going to go bug people, talk to people, learn to code. I'm just going to try and do as much as I can. And he turned around and he said, do you think Elon Musk would take the job, or do you think he would go and build the thing? And I was like, you're right, you know. And then I went back to my boss and I was like, you know, I think I just need to give this a shot. And I said, I'm going to give myself 3 months. If in 3 months nothing happens, I'll just go find a job. No big deal. 3 months isn't a big gap. And in all honesty, it was more for my sense of confidence to say I tried rather than thinking anything would happen. And so at that point, the website was just one continuous page with literally just images and product links. And we were just marketing it on Instagram. It was nothing shiny, nothing flashy. I'd built it. And then I applied for an accelerator. An accelerator is like a business boot camp. You get some funding with it as well. And I didn't even apply for it. There was a guy that in a Facebook group, he was like, we're trying to get more women to apply to the accelerator. He was like, I'm not saying because you're a woman, you'll get a place, but we at least need a pipeline. And because of some of the work I'd been doing at UCL, I emailed him and not even about my business. I was like, hey, I think I could help you. I think I could get more women applying, right? Oh, and by the way, I am working on this little thing, but, you know, like proper downplaying myself, typical, like, oh, I've just got a little project. And then he was like, let's have a coffee. And I've always learned, be ready with a deck. So I went along to the coffee with the deck ready to present my idea in case he asks. And then I presented the idea. I was like, this is our MVP. This is what we're doing at the moment. This is how many users we have. This is what happens, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, so how can I help you? And I was like, so what do I need to do to be ready to apply? And he just looked at me like, you're further along in your idea than most people that apply. Like, and he said, I can fast track you to the interview stage.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my God. And so I went to the interview. They then called me and they were like, this is the easiest yes we've ever said. And that's when the roller coaster seat really went down, because we were going to join an accelerator that January. My sister would be joining, 8 months pregnant. She was going to give birth during the program, and oh, she was my co-founder. And I hid this from them until we got a yes. And because obviously they couldn't say no by the time it happened. And then that was a really steep learning curve. And then one of the investors we met, which then after the program, we raised an angel round. And that was life-changing for us as a company. And one of the investors we met, he was like, you're not a fashion company, you're a media company. And I didn't even know. For me, media was like Guardian Stylist over there, right? And then it was we were like, okay, we're going to relaunch as a media company. So then we did that. And I was like, so how do you make money with a media company? And that's where I understood this whole world of advertising, brand partnerships, things like that. Our first client was eBay. And again, like someone made an intro, he called me and he was like, hey, Nafisa, we were wondering like, if you'd fly over to California, we'll pay for everything. We'll pay for a fee. We'll pay you a project fee, blah, blah. How much would you charge? And I was like, I honestly was like, he's got the wrong person. Because I didn't know this world existed.
Yeah.
And then that became our first client. And then after that, we just kept getting people knocking on our doors, different brands saying, hey, you've got this audience. We want to reach them. Do you think you can help us? And we're like, okay. And then that's where we realized, okay, we're a media company that has an agency that services clients. And that's what we are today. And now we use a lot of that money to reinvest into our community through events, articles, doing the content that we want and creating experiences.
How amazing. And I think that like, it's really lovely when you hear someone's journey of like, the business evolving and taking opportunities where they come, saying yes to things. But also what I'm hearing a lot of through there is what I think a lot of women particularly feel is this imposter syndrome mindset. It's this, yeah. I'm not good enough. I'm not quite ready. And I think it holds a lot of women back from really going after what they really want, because unlike men, and that's a huge generalization, but I do feel it's fair. We see it to be true. I think it's really important that you and I discuss, I guess, how you navigated those moments of, I'm not quite ready, I'm not quite good enough. And really, maybe there's advice that you have that you now give, for example, in your book, which might help women that are listening, just push them over the line to say, oh no, I think I can do this.
Yeah, I think the biggest, so I've got a chapter in my book called The Myth of Imposter Syndrome, which women in particular love, because I talk about it from lots of different angles. So one of the things is that this was my first proper job after university. Of course I was going to feel out of my depth, right? There was no version in which I was going to be like, yeah, I've got this. I've totally got this. I totally know what I'm going to do. And so for me, the first step was like, is it imposter syndrome or is it actually, it's totally rational to feel out of your depth doing this thing and you've just got to keep doing it. That's the only way you're going to feel less out of your depth. The other thing was a racialized and gender aspect to imposter syndrome, in which women often find themselves in spaces, whether that's in the workplace, whether that was me at all these investor dinners where all the investors were male, and realizing that there is a culture and certain environments that do make you feel less than, do make you question how you're meant to show up. You know, women in particular are always told, oh, you know, you almost have to behave like a man to get a sale done or to get funding done and things like that. You know, women will be told that they'll have better chances if they have a male co-founder, et cetera, et cetera. That exists in a certain culture. And so some of it isn't us. Some of it is what we are very really experiencing when we go into certain rooms. And I think what imposter syndrome did was the language of it made of it a very individual problem, rather than saying, actually, there are certain rooms which are just not inclusive to certain people and that impacts how they then show up.
I also think that the stats speak for themselves in terms of how many women, especially female only run businesses, mm-hmm. actually receive funding. I think they're pretty shocking, and I can't remember exactly off the top of my head, but I know that it's a massive imbalance and something that really needs addressing. Is that something that you do within your work now? Do you now look back and see women that are coming up slowly and really, especially within your community, try and amplify those women and help them on that journey?
Yeah, and one of the reasons I wrote the book was because I felt like there were so many people who were trying to build a business which is beyond them. So you all know loads of women who are building incredible things, but it's that bridge between you being the business and you doing everything in the business versus crossing a bridge which is often tied to revenue, where you can build beyond yourself, which then means that you're not so burnt out, which means you can go further, you can do more, you can have a bigger vision. And that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned of everything comes down to the team that you have. There's only so far you can go. And so I find a lot of women now that I either mentor or I have office hours with, and their biggest sort of question is, how do I make this from something that's, say, a side hustle into my full-time every day, which is the big jump that people want to know.
The scary jump.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll be back after this.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome back to Give Me Strength. One of the things I'd love to ask you about, I feel like I hate using the word failure, but I'm going to use it in this context, and also just setbacks in general are quite a crucial part of a journey for anyone through their career and through life as well. So I guess outside of just your career, I'm sure there will have been things that you found particularly challenging that have maybe stood out to you as things that you've had to overcome in order to get to where you are today and the hugely successful woman that you are today. I'd love to hear about some of those moments, because I'm always interested in those. I think they always are the things that shape who we are and how we then come out the other side being stronger for it. So is there anything that stands out to you as being moments that were particularly challenging that have actually propelled you to be the woman and have the career that you are today?
I think one of the things that come to mind, and given the podcast that you run, is the sheer mental and physical resilience you have to be able to build as a founder. And I have come up against that time and time and time again. Me and burnout, best friends, you know, trying not to be, we're trying to be.
We can talk about that.
And I think for me, when there's like a tipping point, which I've found, which is when you're first starting with your business is at the mercy of you. So your business, meaning that everything you do will impact your business. and you're trying to get it going, you're trying to pour your hours in. If you don't do anything, your business doesn't do anything. And then there becomes a tipping point. And this is, and so that first part where your business is at the mercy of you is often a recipe for burnout, because people are often against a clock where they're trying to make it work. They're trying to make it work. Either they might have raised funding and they're like, we've got to make this work, we're going to run out of money. Or just on very real terms, they might have quit their job, or they, you know, people only have so much that they can give. And then there becomes a crossing point where you are then at the mercy of your business. And this is where your business demands things of you. And if you don't work, your business doesn't work, right? And it's sort of like almost out of control, because it's doing well. And that's the bit where I think you have to be, in both bits, you have to be very resilient, both physically and mentally. And I think a lot of companies suffer because their founders suffer, and that what happens to the founder impacts the business. And I've come up against that time and time again. In the first few years of business, my mental and physical health was like, you know. And the thing is, it's difficult, because I'm talking about this all now from hindsight, from a place where I did do that, to now sit here and say this. But I think for me, it was then really understanding that you are a reflection, and your business will reflect what is happening in you. And often I've spoken to founders, and they will always say that in their most miserable moments, you think no one knows. Your whole team knows you're miserable. Your whole team knows that you're burnt out. Your whole team knows. And there is a moment actually last year, because last year I took a 3-month break from work. And there was a moment, we did an event, and it was one of our book clubs, and everyone was going around saying really lovely things about Amalia. And I was sitting there thinking, I hope my face doesn't show how dead I feel inside hearing all this stuff. And in that moment, I knew something had to change, because by this point, it'd been 8 years. By this point, or any good work, any good news that was coming in, I was just thinking, oh, it's more work. So I was like, at which point are you going to be happy? Because even when the work's coming in, you're miserable. If work isn't there, you're going to be miserable. And that's when I really realized I needed to take a break. And it was someone close to me that could see the effect that being spread so thin and having so much going on was having on me. And they just turned around to me and said, what radical step are you going to take in your life to make a change? And I was like, well, talk about putting the mirror up. And then without hesitation, I said, I'm going to take 3 months off. And it was the best decision I've ever made, both for the business and both for myself, because it meant that I suddenly had to hand over all these things I should have handed over a long time. I had to hire a really competent team. And the core of a founder staying well is having an incredible team around them. And in my book, Alex DePledge is someone I interview, and she talks about one of her friends who he was brought into a business which was doing about 6 million in revenue every year. And they were struggling to move forward. And then she said in 18 months, he turned it into a 26 million business. And she turned to him and she said, what did you do different? And he was like, it's people. And he was like, she said, I knew people were important, but I didn't realize it was everything. And I can really resonate with them. And again, it's chicken and egg, because how do you have great people if you can't pay them? You know, so it's like there has to be some level of graft to get you to a place to then be able to have amazing people on board. But I've learned so much about how important good, great people are in order to keep a business and a founder sane.
I also think, and I love those points and I completely agree with you, but I also think there's something that's almost like a wider message in that like, whether you're a business founder that's listening or not, having good people around you is important.
Yeah.
And I think when we think about sort of International Women's Day and the thread that runs through that, and obviously it means different things to different people, but I think that one of the things that I really feel is, you know, whether that be women or just, you know, whoever you want around you, really recognizing the impact of the energy that you carry around you, whether that be a work energy, whether that be at home energy, a social energy, the people that we surround ourselves with have a big impact on who we are and how we can then succeed, whether that be 26 million turnover or just feeling like a happy, healthy person, you know. I think it's really brave that you took 3 months off, because as any founder knows, to relinquish control over something that you have built over years and years is such a big step. So I guess for me, I'd love to hear about what balance now looks like for you. I know that you said you and burnout will go hand in hand, but it is really interesting to hear now from you how you prioritize, I guess, trying to stay being the best founder that you can possibly be. And I guess having some sort of semblance of balance within that so that you can stay at your best.
Yeah, I think two things. The first absolutely is team and the people around you, both professionally, personally. Without a team, there's only so far you're going to go, and you have to have incredible people. And for me, at the heart of incredible people are people who are very values led and have a lot of integrity. That's something I don't compromise on. And often, like, sometimes, you know, people in the team might think I'm being harsh, being like, I don't think we should work with this person. There's these flags, because my bar for integrity is quite high. But I've never regretted it. And I've always regretted the other side, where I've ignored my gut on people, companies, things like that. But I think finding really good people is the night and day difference in being able to have balance. That's like a given. I couldn't have taken 3 months off without incredible people in the team. So shout out to my team. And then the second one is, years ago, I hosted a panel. This was literally like 2016. And I remember one of the panel members, Jo, she said that she was having a mental breakdown, her business, blah, 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 everything we kind of know and talk about. And she said, the moment where I became a better founder was where I cared less. And I only understood that last year, like, deeply. And it's not caring less in terms of lower standards or anything like that. It's giving less headspace to your business because you have other things in your life. And I first sort of came across this in about 2019, where everything I did was tied to the company. If I was volunteering, it was somehow tied to Malia. If I was going to an event, it was somehow to everything. My whole identity was being the CEO of Malia. If I went somewhere, people were like, hi, so how's your business? How's it going? And when things aren't going well, you don't want anyone to ask you, how's your business?
No, you definitely don't.
And I had a moment where I was like, if the business stop tomorrow, who am I? Like, what do I have left? And I started taking up taekwondo. And because taekwondo is an individual sport, it's not a team sport. And I needed something that was just about me, because everything else was about the company. And so I started doing taekwondo, which I would really recommend a martial art for resilience building, because getting kicked in the head really builds your resilience.
Really builds your resilience quite quickly.
And so I started doing that. And I am a serial hobbyist. I love hobbies. I will immerse myself obsessively into hobbies and then abandon them and then come back a year later. And so for me to have more headspace for the business, ironically, is about having more headspace for other things. So last year, during my break, I bought myself a pottery wheel.
Wow. Oh my God.
Now that's like my obsessive hobby. But it's amazing how when you create, it's almost like anti-logic, but when you create so much space for other stuff in your life, you genuinely become a better founder and a better person for what you need to, like, how you need to show up. I've become more creative. I've become way more patient. I've become way more resilient in ways that I didn't expect. And I think creativity, doing things with your hands, doing things with your body, does that for your mind. And you will know.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm literally sitting here nodding my head off. Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's really about, as well, like, I absolutely love what you said, like, being a person outside of being a business. And I think being someone that spent a long time on social media, you know, I feel like I've really, over the last few years, had to carve out, like, what is me? If everything, you know, went tomorrow, who am I? What do I like? What do I enjoy? And I particularly think that I agree with you, having creative outlets is really important within that. And I think, you know, whether that's fitness, it doesn't have to be, whether it's getting a coloring book and doing that once a week, whatever it might be, I think that I really resonate with everything you say in terms of finding something that allows you to release that part of you, because I think we all have it within us.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes we're so stifled by what we should be doing, and also what work looks like. Like, I really love that you said doing those things makes you a better founder, because I know that there will be many people who are, you know, very tied to their jobs listening, who think that work and more work is the only way to move forwards.
Yeah.
And actually, it's really interesting to hear someone who's kind of trodden that path say, actually moving away from work, doing something that allowed me to be creative, that took me away and the focus away from the business, made me better in order to move forwards. I think that's a really nice way of looking at it.
Yeah, and I think part of it as well is because with social media, work sometimes is so fast paced. Content today is gone tomorrow, you know? And we both work in that space. Mm. And I feel like the next sort of stretch of work that I'm embarking on requires me to think longer term, requires me to think slower, requires me to do more strategic and bigger work. And that stuff doesn't happen like that. That stuff has to marinate, you know? And I find that when I'm riding a bike, when I'm doing pottery, when I'm in the shower, when I'm doing these things that use my body, my ideas, how I think, how I look at the world, how I approach a problem, it changes radically. And it's so hard to quantify that. You know, like with workouts, you can say, oh yeah, I can tell the workout's working because X, Y, Z. But it's so hard to quantify that doing this stuff makes you better in these other ways. But I really think we are made to massage our brains with all these other things apart from work. And if anyone is in that sort of space of like, there must be more, I don't think I'm like operating well, I would really recommend The Artist's Way. Have you done it?
I haven't, but I've heard a lot about it.
I think it is for everyone. And I think everyone has that creative self in them, which at some age ends up getting stifled because it's no longer commercially useful. It's no longer useful in the world of work, in the world of paying our bills. And for those that are artists, even then they have to be a commercial artist. Most people have to make money from the art that they create. But I would really recommend it for people to just try and discover a different side of themselves that they might not ever have found in any other way.
I can tell my podcast producer's just literally written that down. Like, The Artist's Way, everyone's going to be like, right, I need to put that on my list of things to do. I'm going to make a note of that. One of the things that I think it's really important that we discuss today, given that your work really centers around this, is how we look at diversity within the kind of media space and beyond, and particularly for women from minoritized backgrounds, how you feel that kind of progress is being made. I think it's really important that you speak from a place of authority on this, and I'd love to hear from you how far you think we've come and also how far we also need to go in order to get to where you think would be a good place.
Yeah, God, it's so hard. I always feel like at moments like International Women's Day, you have that moment of, we've come so far, but have we?
Mm.
You know, and you know, I started working on Amalia as an idea in like 2014, 2015. So it's been a long enough stretch of time to do a bit of recce and look back. And there's moments where I think, yes, we've come far. And there's moments, especially intergenerationally, where I think about what was the existence of my ancestors and my aunties and my cousins versus my existence. And you can see such differences both in like how we dream and how we think and what we think is possible for us. And so I think at the level of what we believe is possible for women today has drastically changed to lots of degrees. But then I think where I feel more disheartened is when I look at the granular, when I look at particular industries or even companies, when I look at media and marketing and things like that, where it still feels like, you know, we see it firsthand because we work with lots of clients and things like that. And normally I say you can see the change by following the money trail, and you can see that often how diversity sort of slips in and off the radar and in and out of budgets because it's just seen as a nice to have. And you see that when, for example, a recession happens and budget cuts happens, suddenly clients and companies and campaigns say, oh, actually, we're just going to stick to what we know and stick to what's safe. And I think, you know, the last 2-3 years, we've seen a huge number of startups and companies that have been founded by people of color that have closed down. And there's been fundraising issues, there've been climate issues, so many things. And so I see, you know, loads of people making great strides, but then I also see this mass closure. You know, Galdem was a media platform that sat within our industry. We were incredible colleagues and peers in the space, and I really feel like we've lost something that was worth so much. And so I still think there's a lot of untapped and underfunded potential, specifically amongst women of color. And I see this especially because I see so many women doing so well in their careers, but when they're trying to go it alone in trying to make a business work, it's not like for like. And we know there are so many opportunity issues. So they're just underestimated, underfunded, you know? And so I have hope because I see so many women doing incredible things, but then I also hear the inner conversations of companies and clients, and I just think nothing's changed because nothing at the top's changed. And ultimately, we all know budget, money, all of that comes from high up there. Yeah, and
it does,
and trickles down.
That was a really interesting answer and really insightful, and I think that it's why we need more people like yourself who are really like paving the way. I think that to finish today's conversation, it'd be really nice to hear from you about women that have inspired you on your own journey. You know, like I said, it's International Women's Day, and as much as there's lots of different cliches within that, I'm sure that there are women both in business and in your personal life who have maybe inspired or encouraged you to get to where you are today. And I'd love to hear a couple of them if you can.
Yeah. My first is Alex DePledge, who was one of my first mentors, and she was on the interview panel for the accelerator that I did. And she messaged me on Twitter after, and she was like, hey, love what you're doing, like, let's chat. And Alex didn't know I'd been fangirling her for a long time, but I'd been waiting for the right time on, like, because I wanted to go to her with something. And she'd like hosted a show on BBC, I think it was about women, girls coding. And I remember tweeting her being like, hey, Alex, loved you on the show. I'm building something, would love to have a chat. And she replied to me and she said, sure, send me an email. And she said, be specific. And this is before the interview. And because she said, be specific, I was like, I've got to time this right. I've got one shot and I've got to use it well. So I didn't email her, right? Because I was like, let me just bide my time. And then not knowing that that was the same person that had tweeted her then, she DM'd me after the interview and was like, let's chat. And then we ended up chatting and she was like, look, I think you're like onto something. I think you can do really well. And she was like, do you want office space in my company? And let's see if like we can help you. You can have access to my whole team. And it was just incredibly generous. And they were based in Oval at the time. And they had their marketing team, their ops team. At the time, they were a marketplace for cleaners. They had raised like millions. At that time, they were actually on their way to exit to sell the company for millions as well. Alex now has her second business. And she just had such generosity and wealth of knowledge as well. She was literally like, here, take it. And I remember she was like, you might be wondering why I'm doing this for you. And she was like, when I started out, there was a guy called Mills and he did the same for me and he gave me office space. And then what ended up happening is I got introduced to Mills through someone else, not knowing that these two had any connection. And when I met Mills, someone just said, I think you should, we were fundraising at the time, and someone said, you should talk to Mills, he might be interested. And I went thinking Mills might introduce me to people. And then by the time I had, and Mills is a really intense people person, he was just like, so what are you building? He's really interested in me as a founder and whether I had the grit to go and make this thing happen. And then we met, was lovely. And then I got on the train, got off the train, got reception. And then she emailed me and she said, Mills just emailed me asking if you're legit. I think he wants to put money in. And then I found, and I was like, Mills, Alex, what? And she was like, Mills was the person who gave me desk space. That's why I gave you desk space. And she has just always championed founders, startups. She's tried to also make a lot of cultural change around founders and their sort of culture in the UK. So she's like one of my incredible mentors that I had that really, really also showed me a different way of being a founder, because she is so unapologetic. You should definitely go on her on the podcast. She's just incredible.
I would love to. She sounds amazing. Yeah. I'm like, quick, write her name down.
And she kind of like, just, she just didn't care. She just would show up in rooms asking for what she wants in the way that she wants. She didn't care what the status quo was. And I'm so glad she was one of my first people that I came across who was just like, yeah, just show up however you want, you know? And then another person on Saturday, I watched a play at Rich Mix called Desperate Times. And it was produced by a company called Side Eye, and her name is Hannah Abdullah. And I am so inspired by Hannah because I think she is an example of, she has created such space in the arts. Last year, they were at Edinburgh Fringe Festival with their play Across the 30 Days. And she has ushered in such new talent, talent that might be overlooked in other spaces. And I always really respect people who, you're sidelined as it is within the industry, but you go above and beyond to make sure other people are ushered in and you're fighting to create space. And I think people like that, it's only really in hindsight, in like 10 years, 20 years time, where we realize the weight of what they've achieved and the weight of what they've done, and that they created and carved out this incredible space, this incredible community, both from bringing on emerging writers. So like the play that I saw was acted by someone called Najma, and she hadn't acted since like GCSE, and she just thought, I just want to try. And she was incredible. She was so funny.
Wow.
And someone like that wouldn't have got a bet put on them unless their auntie would have sorted them out, you know?
Yeah.
And so I have so much respect for incredible women who I feel like are bridging the gap of nepotism and creating their own cultural spaces to say, do you know what? We're going to put a bet on ourselves. We're going to put resource and time behind you and produce the show. And there was like two producers, artistic, like it was just incredible. It was really inspiring. And so I'm really inspired by people who are creating specifically in industries and spaces where we haven't seen ourselves take lead. So yeah, shout out to Hannah as well.
Those are two amazing, you know, kind of people to have as your inspirations. And I also think that particularly in the theatre space, in the arts world, I think that's an area that, you know, that was my background. And I think that it's an area that needs a lot of work. But wow, what an incredible person. And I will definitely be looking her up. I really want to say a massive thank you for your time and your energy today. I know you're the busiest person. So it's actually amazing that we've even managed to get you here. So I just wanted to say a massive thank you. I'm really pleased that there is someone like you in the world doing the work that you're doing. And really, like, yeah, I get goosebumps thinking about it, because I think that, you know, it takes a lot to have courage to start something new, but especially in a space where maybe you're not represented and you don't feel as though you're maybe as heard as others. So I really just want to take a moment to give you a massive round of applause. No, and just to really thank you for your time and your wisdom. And one thing I really would recommend is Nafisa's book. We'll put a link to that in the show notes, and anything else she's got coming up. So Nafisa, thank you so much, and thanks for being my International Women's Day guest.
Thank you for having me.
So thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I'll be back on Friday for my Ask Alice. Again, if you have any questions for that, send us an email to the email that's in the show notes. If you are enjoying the podcast and you'd like to hear a little more from me, I am so excited to announce that I have just written my latest book, Give Me Strength, How I Turned My Back on Restriction, Nurtured the Body I Love, and How You Can Too. It comes out in July and is available for pre-order now. And it's the book I wish I had read when I was really struggling with body image and exercise addiction. And so if this sounds like something that might help you, you can find the link to get your copy in the show notes now. I'll be back next Wednesday for my next episode, and I look forward to speaking to you then. Give Me Strength is an Insanity Studios production. The podcast producer is Saffron Mirza, and podcast production assistant is Abby Sandler.